Is this, does it have one and two? Yeah, I guess it does. So this is Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 29, Talks Between Narada and King Pratibharhi. And we're back to text 1 again. We're going backwards. Sarvesham eva jantatunam satatam deha poshane asti pragya samayata kovisheshas tadanrinam sarvesham eva jantunam satatam deha poshane asti pragya samayata kovisheshas tadarinam. Samayata Kovishesha Satarinam. Ladies, Sarvesham Eva Jantunam Sadatam Deha Bhoshane Samayata Visheshastadhanrinam Sarveshameva Jantunam Satyatam Beva Poshane Ayasamayata Kovisheshastadhanrinam Sarvesham all, eva, certainly, jantunam, of animals, satatam, always, deha poshane, to maintain the body, asti, there is, pragya, intelligence, samayata, resting on. Ko, ka, what? Visheshaha, differences. Tata, then. Nrinam, of the human beings. The other verse, which is also on the board, which I'll just read. Lavdve hante manushyatvam hitva deya sad graham Atmas Stritya Vihayedam Jivatma Savishishite. Translation purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. A desire to maintain body, wife, and children is also observed in animal society. The animals have full intelligence to manage such affairs. If a human being is simply advanced in this respect, what is the difference between him and an animal? One should be very careful to understand that this human life is obtained after many, many births in the evolutionary process. A learned man who gives up the bodily conception of life, both gross and subtle, will, by the enlightenment of spiritual knowledge, become a prominent individual spirit soul, as the Lord is also. Purport, it is said that a man is a rational animal, but from this verse we can also understand that rationality exists even in animal life. Unless there is rationality, how can an animal maintain its body by working so hard? That the animals are not rational is untrue. Their rationality, however, is not very advanced. In any case, we cannot deny them rationality. The point is that one should use one's reason to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for that is the perfection of human life. So I'm not exactly clear where this is. Special note. According to Vijayadvaja Tirtha, who belongs to the Madhvacharya Sampradaya, the first two of the following verses appear after verse 45 of this chapter. So this would be 46 and 47. And the remaining two verses appear after verse 79. Okay. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasvatam Deve Gauravani Bhircharane Nirvishesha Shunivadi Paskyatya Desatarne. Here it mentions that man is supposed to be a rational animal. So what does rationality mean? According to Bhagavad Gita, it doesn't mean making plans for controlling the material nature for sense gratification. Of course, sense gratification may mean many different varieties of things. It may be eating, sleeping, and mating, and also defense. In modern society, the scientists are proud that they were able to build an atomic weapon. But that's not exactly a display of human intelligence. As Prabhupada would say, previously people would kill each other with rocks. They'd throw the rock and hit you on the head and kill you. So if they advance to the point where they can throw an atomic bomb and kill you, it's not exactly advancement. At least not human advancement. Because everyone's going to die anyhow. To make something to kill us quicker is not exactly human intelligence. On the other hand, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has said clearly, evam bude param budva sam stabhyatmanam atmana jahi shatru mahabaho kamarupam durasadam. Thus knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind, and intelligence, one should control the lower self by the higher, and thus by spiritual strength, conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. In other words, indriyani paranyahur, indriyabhyak paramanak, manasastu paro buddhira, yo buddhe paratastu saha. That the working senses are superior to dull matter. The mind is higher than the senses, the intelligence is higher than the mind, and he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence. In other words, we have an opportunity to control our mind and senses. Exactly how we're controlling our mind and senses is not perhaps directly controlling, in the sense just like I may think I'm moving this microphone right now by my hand. The soul, if we take into account that he's transcendental, eternal, and beyond the modes of material nature, despite contact with the material body or Arjuna, the soul is neither doing anything nor is he entangled. So if we're not doing anything, then how is it that we have any responsibility for what's going on? On the other hand, what does it mean that we're controlling our mind and senses? One side it says, we're not doing anything, we're not entangled. The other sense, we said, we have to control our mind and senses. But then it says we're not to control it. But then we have to become going to control. So what is this? Very confusing. So it appears in the verses of Bhagavad Gita that the desire is the form of conditioning for the soul. The soul, we ourselves, are so subtle, and we're very small. We're only 1/10,000th the size of the tip of hair in size, which is very inconceivably tiny. And yet our consciousness is pervading the body, and therefore we're certainly aware to some extent, to some limited extent, what's going on inside the body, or outside the body also, to some very limited extent. So we do have consciousness, and we are conscious, but whether by my will the hand is moving, that's disputed by the fact that if it was my will moving the hand, then why is it that sometimes I want the hand to move, but it doesn't move? And sometimes I don't want the hand to move, and it moves anyhow. So my will is not the only factor in the, whether the hand's going to move or not. Of course, if I want the hand to move, if I desire it, then there is much more of a probability, if my body is healthy, that it's going to move. But this is explained in Bhagavad Gita that the material nature is the cause of all activities and its effects. And the living entities are the cause of the different happiness and distress. In other words, the connection with the soul and the body appears to be through the super soul and the material nature. The soul desires, and according to Bhagavad Gita, Krishna senses the desire of the soul just like one can understand the flavor of a flower by smelling it. So Krishna understands what our desires are. He also understands what our merits are, what we deserve. And therefore, he inconceivably is able to make all the arrangements simultaneously in the material world to satisfy people's desires according to what they deserve. And therefore the material nature continuously flows out of Krishna's, as it says, ultimately it's Mahavishnu's dream of which we're taking part in. So what is our responsibility? Our responsibility is what kind of desires we're going to accept. And what kind of desires we're going to accept will depend to a large extent about who we choose to take association with and what kind of association we choose to have when we decide who we're going to associate with. It's not enough just to be physically in contact with others. We also have to decide what kind of, how we're going to be in contact with them. And most of that comes from hearing. People are speaking, supposedly speaking is a product of intelligence, and therefore we're receiving a perspective, a vision, a understanding of feeling, a what is desirable to do, what is undesirable to do. This is all obtained by hearing. And then we watch people's examples, and we try to match it up, what they're talking about, and what they're doing. And then we decide if we're going to follow them or who we're going to follow, whose instructions we're going to follow, whose example we're going to follow. And this is all in the realm of desiring. So with our intelligence and our senses, we're in our mind, we're perceiving things, and then we're making decisions based upon the information available to us and the desires that are appearing within our mind. Therefore, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, apuryamanam achala pratishtam. Well, actually, before that, he says a lot of things, of course. But that's only the second chapter. But he says, vihaya kamya... What is that? What is night for all sentient beings is the time awakening for the self-controlled. And what is the time awakening for all sentient beings is the night for the introspective sage. Ya nisha sarabhutanam tasyam jagati bhutani tasyam jagrati bhutani sa nisha pashyato mune. In other words, there are two different kinds of people. One of them are hearing knowledge about how to gratify the senses. And that comes in endless varieties, because we can see that there are so many varieties of possibilities to gratify the senses. Generally, we divide it up into four: eating, sleeping, mating, defending. And that's, generally speaking, that the senses are demanding and we're fulfilling the desires of the senses, or we desire that the senses become gratified in some way. But then we have the mind, which even without any impulse from the senses, just creates things out of nothing and makes them objectives for sense gratification. Out of nowhere, someone becomes my enemy. Out of nowhere, I want to jump off a bridge, etc. Of course, maybe it's not out of nowhere, but it's just, it has nothing to do with perhaps what's actually going on. It's just a creation of the mind, of our imagination. And then we take that as we're being pushed to do that also. So the mind is also taken as one of the senses, which also push us in a varieties of sometimes creative or non-creative ways. Now, above the senses and the mind, there is the intelligence. And it's with our intelligence, either our intelligence is either material or spiritual. When the intelligence is material, then it's a utilized in order to think of plans of how to satisfy the demands of the mind and senses. And when it's spiritual, then the intelligence is utilized to control what we call control the mind and senses, which in other words means to utilize the mind and the senses in the service of Krishna under higher authority. And that's called, at least in the beginning, maybe Varnashram. And on the higher level, it's called Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and ultimately Bhakti Yoga, different levels of understanding and surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, different levels of knowledge and renunciation, and then ultimately cultivating devotion. So as that famous example goes, which illustrates it, which I guess is the best example I know, that a man's walking down on the street and he sees a beautiful woman and his mind and senses say, go get her. And the intelligence says, wait a second. She has a dot on her forehead, and she has a man next to her. She might be married. And the mind senses say, oh, come on. We heard this so many times, this old-fashioned philosophy. Next, he's going to quote from that book called the Bhagavad Gita. Let's see. Let's hear it. No one believes this, you know, mythology and this sentiment anymore. The philosophy that if you read the new, you've gone to school, you're not a fool. Just follow the real philosophy. If it feels good, then you just go for it. You just do it. So the soul, he has to make a decision. If there's not very much intelligence, if he's not very experienced, then he may decide, my dear intelligence, what do you have to say? Well, I don't know. I didn't want to buy the Bhagavad Gita. You're the one who did it. Besides that, they said it was free, and then they asked for a donation. So I'm innocent. Okay, then the soul says, all right, think of a way to, you know, meet this woman. So the intelligence tells the mind senses, yes, I have a plan. Write her a letter. Tell her she's the most beautiful person you've seen. And then put in very small letters so she can't read it in the last 2 weeks. Try and be honest. Tell her you're madly in love with her. You want to meet her in such and such place at such and such time. And you promise her you'll give her the sun and the moon. And if she's very nice, you'll actually give her a couple of extra stars. But don't sign the letter, because that man next to her looks twice as big as you are. So in this way, the intelligence is being utilized as a vehicle to gratify the mind and senses. There's a means by which the senses and mind become gratified from their desires that are pushing us or that appear within them. On the other hand, if the intelligence is more spiritualized, then the intelligence says, oh no, if you do that, you'll wind up in the same place you did the last time you did that, in a very difficult place. So my suggestion is, take this book, Bhagavad Gita, go up to her, go up to them, and try and sell them the book. Engage them in devotional service. And ask for a donation, of course. So in that way, instead of becoming controlled by the senses, the urges of the senses and mind, the intelligence supersedes the urges of the senses and mind, and engages the senses and mind in Krishna's service. And by such service, then one becomes conscious of Krishna, and in the consciousness of Krishna and the atmosphere of the spirit, internal energy, then the senses and mind become purified of their impulses, and therefore, and the intelligence becomes further purified by contact with Krishna. And so therefore the desire to gratify the senses not only doesn't take place, is not fulfilled, but also the senses and mind become purified. So in the future, one will not have the similar urges, similar ideas for sense gratification. That's called viṣya-vinivartante. Niraharasyadehinam rasavarjam rasopyasya paramdrishva nivartate. That the embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, just like the person may say, well, I won't go up to that lady, I won't write her a letter, I'm just going to think of her day and night. So one may be restricted from sense enjoyment, although the taste for sense objects remains, but ceasing such engagements by experiencing the higher taste, one is fixed in knowledge, in consciousness. So that's the whole idea, is that human life has an opportunity in the varna and ashram system. One may not be so much conscious of Vishnu that one is doing this to please Krishna. As a matter of fact, one may not even do it really to please Krishna. One may do it simply for one's own sense gratification. Because, according to Bhagavad Gita, yami mam pushpitam vacham pravadant yavipaschita Veda Vatarata Parta Nainam Astiti Varinam Karmatmaka Swaga Para Janma Karam Phala Pradam Kriya Visheshu Bahulam Vogaishvara Kitim Prati. Those of small knowledge, they think that the only purpose of the Vedas is for fruitive activities, elevation to the higher planets, sense gratification, so forth, they think that there is no higher purpose in life than this. They call Veda Vataratas. So they follow the Vedas, they follow Krishna's instructions, but they do so simply to get some material gain. But still, because they're following Krishna's instructions, therefore they become benefited. Or even Prabhupada writes that one may even execute devotional service, but at the beginning, one knows that the goal is Krishna. Should be the goal, but one is addicted to the results of his activities. He wants to enjoy the results of activities. So that's called, Prabhupada says, karma yoga. There is some higher consciousness, but the higher consciousness is utilizing because the one's addiction to sense gratification for fruitive activities. And when one knows that the goal is Krishna, and he takes pleasure in mental speculation to understand Krishna, then he's said to be acting in Jnana Yoga. But when one knows that the goal is Krishna and acts in Krishna consciousness simply to please Krishna, then he's said to be acting in Bhakti Yoga or Buddha Yoga. Really actually fully utilizing one's intelligence in Krishna's service. Understanding things properly, putting everything in the proper perspective, and at the same time working simply according to Krishna's directions, not becoming attached to the results of one's activities or becoming bewildered due to lack of complete knowledge over actually whether Krishna is God or not, or whether we're actually his servants. That when one is actually acting in Buddha Yoga or Bhakti Yoga, then all of that is very clear. That's why we're supposed to chant our rounds and just listen, rather than listen to our minds. Or, what to speak of listening to our minds, chanting Hare Krishna, making plans, what we're going to accomplish. Or chanting Hare Krishna and trying to figure out some philosophical point, you know, why am I chanting Hare Krishna to begin with? No one is trying to chant and actually call out to Srimati Radharani and Krishna, please engage me in your loving service. Then if we do that, then there is some possibility, according to our sincerity, of actually doing it sincerely. And then remembering spontaneously by Krishna's mercy, Krishna's forms, Krishna's associates, his qualities, feeling his presence, the presence of his devotees, and eventually remembering his pastimes and coming to the platform meditating on trance and Krishna consciousness. So that's actually human form of life. Human form of life, Prabhupada once writes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, begins at the brahminical stage of life when one is actually utilizing one's intelligence to follow Krishna's instructions. Of course, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, they're also acting according to Krishna's instructions, but generally it's for sense gratification, but not necessarily. In other words, it depends whether they're devotees or not. So Varnan Ashram system is not sufficient in itself. It's called Shravam Eva Hi Kevalam, just following the instructions, unless one is actually, the only thing that makes it proper and not a waste of time if it's ultimately done for Krishna, in Krishna to develop Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, the Varnashram system is just another more sophisticated activities for sense gratification. But with the hope that eventually one may come to the human form of life and understand things properly, not act simply on the basis of the mind and senses or the perverted intelligence. So I'll stop there. Either, thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Why does Krishna bother us to the demons? Why doesn't he live for the time?
Time. Because demons live for a long time. Krishna's not so patient. No, these are Krishna's pastimes. Why does he kill demons? Because he likes killing demons. That's why he does everything. But it's not like he has some perverted liking for killing demons, because he knows it's for their benefit. For number one, the demons get benefited just by having his touch. And number two, it's part of his pastimes. It makes, when we hear about Krishna, it makes life more exciting. Makes his pastimes more exciting. If it was the only pastime he had was dancing with the gopis, it'd get boring after some time. It would be a very incomplete personality. Everyone likes a good fight. So therefore Krishna tries to arrange it so that the demons he kills are a little more than, he doesn't walk down the street, generally speaking, you know, some punk from the corner jumps Krishna and Krishna kills him. It wouldn't be a very fair match. And when he fights with a demon, he fights with someone like Hiranyakashipu, half the size of the universe. Make it things more exciting. So that these things can be written in the Bhagavatam or the Ramayana, and we can read them and take interest in them, and that way have Krishna's association that way. Yes.
Yeah,
our duty is to hear about, glorify, and remember Krishna. And serve Krishna with his desire. In other words, there are desires, there are instructions coming from Krishna and his representatives. They ask us to do certain different things with this body, mind, and our words. So our duty is to hear those instructions, try to understand what they are, assimilate them, and put them into practice in our life. And when Krishna sees that we're doing that steadily and enthusiastically, then he gives us more and more intelligence how to do things in his service. So we have the capacity to desire because we're living entities, we're conscious persons, and therefore we should desire ultimately to understand what Krishna wants and then do those things to please him. Anything else? Yes.
How does one evolve this desire to please him? How does one make the transition from karma, from karma yoga to bhakti yoga?
So. Practice. Everything takes practice. We have to hear from the right sources what our next step is. Well, we have to hear all the steps, but then we have to understand what my next step is, and then we have to desire to take that next step. We have to find out in which way we're desiring or doing things which are contrary to Krishna service, just like eating too much or endeavoring too much or idle talk, or associating with worldly-minded persons, or being greedy for mundane achievements. So we have to develop the positive things. Enthusiasm, confidence, patience, following the authoritative persons, their footsteps, giving up worldly-minded association. And that way, by following that, then Krishna will help us. We develop that because when Krishna sees we're desiring properly, then he encourages us by revealing himself. And the more we become conscious of Krishna, the more we become enlightened, the more we see things properly, and the more blissful we become, free from all anxiety, and ultimately we experience positive happiness in Krishna's association. Yes?
Giving in a temple and doing service for prasadam, is this also sanctification?
Doing service for prasadam. What do you mean? You mean we're working here just to get something to eat? Well, it's not a very high standard of pure devotional service. We could probably make some improvement on it. But at least you're in the right place. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Grantharaj Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.